I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF. Thank you for listening to my show. I'm happy you're here. I appreciate you being here. I'm thrilled today to present to you a conversation with the thoughtful and trippy Duncan Trussell. Duncan Trussell, who I've known for a while. We've hung out a couple of times. I always enjoy him. He's a pleasant, thoughtful man, curious, intelligent, hilarious. Duncan is a comedian. He used to do this trippy thing with a puppet that I enjoyed. It was out there, man. But at the time, he briefly worked at the Comedy Store, and he was the guy responsible, you know, 20 years after the fact, for getting my name painted on the wall. And I will talk to him about that. I will. All right, look, I know I'm a little edgy. I'm still a little sick. I enjoy talking to you people, and it's my pleasure right now to talk to Duncan Trussell. I hope you enjoy this. I had a very nice time with Duncan.
Today I...
What is the routine, Duncan?
Well, the routine is I wake up, walk my dog.
Yeah.
Down by the LA River.
What kind of dog?
A little chihuahua.
What kind
of
dog? You have
a
chihuahua?
A chihuahua Jack Russell.
What kind of
dog?
Do you inherit
that?
So what was what kind of business was your family in?
Well, my mom was a psychologist.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And my dad was a, he ran a shopping center.
Like a strip mall?
Yeah.
Yeah?
In Mobile, Alabama.
In Mobile, Alabama.
Yeah, this is after the divorce.
Uh-huh.
Before that, he was a lot of different things.
He was one of those guys?
Yeah.
What's dad doing this week?
Yeah.
What were some of the, what was the list?
It was always involved, he always worked at like real estate offices.
Commercial real estate?
Yeah, in
right.
the South, you know, right. like, or business, yeah, business, yeah, business real estate.
Right, and right.
So yeah, that was part of going to visit him was, you know, he would try to, his idea was to like turn us into men.
Yeah.
So he would like give us just these shitty fucking jobs working
yeah.
for his company.
Yeah.
You know, like in the South, like chopping fucking shrubs in the South all day.
Yeah.
Always fending off molestation.
What do you mean fending off molestation?
There was just this weird old guy who like worked down in the shop where I had to work.
Yeah.
And like I can remember, it was just this bad vibe I got from him. And
yeah.
like he was always getting a little too close to me. And then
yeah.
like at one point he's like, I got a pacemaker. He's like, put your ear to my mouth. Listen, listen. And like opened his mouth. And like I didn't put my ear in his mouth, but like.
Did you hear the ocean?
Yeah, you heard the ocean screaming. Get me out of this perverted old man.
What did you hear when you stuck your ear to his mouth?
I heard my own adrenaline. Just like, what's happening? Like, why is this happening to me? He says, like, my pacemaker sounds like a little bird.
That is the weirdest.
Yeah.
I guess if you're a little kid, you're like, nah, that you might do that.
Yeah, but he.
Is that the end of the memory?
That's, well, no, actually, I trapped some cats that summer. There was, like, some stray cats, mm-hmm. little kittens, and, like, I trapped them and then took them back home, but then they were feral, and I couldn't...
What's that got to do with the old man?
I don't know, Mark.
All right, same period. It
happened in the same period, yeah.
Yeah. All right. So that's your dad's doing.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's my dad's doing. I don't blame my dad. That's just the world.
Yeah,
you know?
But he set you up with the gig.
He was trying to get show me what hard work was like, I guess.
But it doesn't sound like he was doing it.
That's funny. Well, no, I mean, he's working at a desk. Exactly. I wish I'd thought of that when we were driving through a Hardee's drive-thru at 6 a.m. and I knew I had to go chop weeds for the day.
He's going to sit out somewhere.
What a great point.
A couple phone calls. So your mom was a clinical psychologist?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Hippie style or straight up?
I'm going to say hippie style.
Uh-huh.
For sure.
Yeah.
Hippie style. Yeah.
So you had the books around?
Yes.
Ah,
yes. Yeah. How do you know about the books?
Well, which ones? Which ones did you get into?
Jonathan Livingston Seagull. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, sure. That falls under hippie psychology. Sure.
Yeah. You know, those kinds of books.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Jack Kornfield, of course, Ram Dass. Like,
yeah.
I really got in. I still love
She Ram had the Ram Dass books?
Well, she had these cassette tapes.
Uh-huh.
Like, you remember when they used to, like, they used to have, like, these weird, like, I don't know, plastic containers filled with, like, an audio lecture
series? Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Sure,
so
sure,
she had
sure.
those.
With
so.
No labels on them, just to, like, one Ram Dass at so and so.
Yes.
one and then two.
Exactly.
And then, yeah, yeah.
That was it. So we would listen to those in the car as like as we drove. And I didn't really care for it at the time.
Because
like,
you wanted to listen to music.
Yeah, and I just didn't want to do anything my mom was doing. So yeah.
She was the enemy?
Yeah.
Not the other guy?
Not my dad. Huh. No, it was my mom. My mom and I had a really like...
Uh-huh.
On the, like, turbulent sort of relationship.
Isn't interesting? You seem to be more in the groove of what she inspired now than the opposite. You're not doing commercial real estate. You're thinking about Satanism and listening to Manson records.
That's not what my mom did. But the antidote...
A journey of the mind is what I'm saying.
A journey
of the mind.
Yeah, well, I love... I'm not going to say I don't like listening to Manson records or reading about Charles Manson.
One of the great entertainers of the 20th century.
Really was, man. Yeah. One of the great performance artists and
unbelievable.
Truly a staple of American
real risk taker.
Yeah, real risk taker. He went for it.
He sure did go for it.
He fucking went for it, man.
Yeah. All right, so you got the books. So that's where something must have gotten through then, listening to that 60s shit, right?
Well, I think that...
How old are you?
I'm 39.
All right, so they were probably just a little older than me.
Wow, yeah, I guess so.
So I'm 50.
Yeah, right. I guess so.
So they were actual boomers. They probably, you know, kind of muddled through the 60s and all that explosion somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
That's right.
So your mom picked up on that kind of like, you know, we can make it a good place if we change our minds business.
My mom didn't pick on it. My mom, what happened is my mom went through a divorce and then somewhere after that, she started finding out about this stuff. She wasn't a hippie.
Uh-huh.
She was, our family on her side is a very traditional Southern family. So
really?
Yes. She wasn't a hippie. As far as I'm aware, when she married my dad, I don't think she became a hippie then. It was when we came to North Carolina that she started coming into contact with that stuff. And
she was ready to rebel in a way? Because what, your parents, like they met and they were both kind of regular Southern conservative people. And then the divorce kind of fucked her head up?
Yeah. Yes.
Right.
I think so.
Yeah.
Because that's what happens is you... I mean, I think that happens to so many people is they don't consider they don't even think about why they're getting married. And back then, you didn't even think, like, why would I get married or do this? You just do it.
Let alone have kids. Well, look what we did.
Yeah.
Now what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then suddenly the thing starts curdling and falling apart. And it's not like now where everyone gets, where getting married is just a sort of, I don't even know what it is.
I'm not sure either.
Back then it was a very serious thing. And so then when the divorce falls apart and you end up with two fucking kids and that's a wonderful contact with truth. And I think whenever you come in contact with truth, sometimes it'll push you in the direction of trying to, you know, understand how to get closer to that facet of the universe. And a lot of those books help you do that in a way that I don't think they teach you anywhere else.
So when you say truth is a facet of the universe, which one were you referring to? Children?
Impermanence.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you mean that it ends?
Yeah, not just that it ends, but everything ends.
Yeah.
Like everything
some
ends.
Faster than others.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
It's a matter of pacing and timing.
Yeah. Well, even the way you feel like right now, that's going to change. Like everything's in this constant state of flux and it's one of the aspects of living in the West is that you're taught that things don't really change or that you should expect things to stay the same.
Well, that you're looking for some security and some context that will make you feel like, well, this is my life now.
Yeah.
I'm in it. Everything's changing.
Yeah.
Always.
Always.
And you just got to live with that. Why fight it?
Yeah.
You know, that we're, you know, you're not going to stop it. You know, we're fighting entropy here.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Yes.
We're not just fighting. I mean, it's funny because we are entropy. It's we're entropy fighting itself. And
I'm breaking apart right now.
I'm watching you vaporize in front of me. It's amazing to see.
I only do it for certain people.
It's so cool. I thought you could do that. You can aerosolize yourself. That's amazing.
Yeah, it took a lot of practice.
Wow.
It happened by accident. I had gas, and then I found, like, what? But, like, let's track the mind-blowing because, I mean, at some point, you started thinking about things in a different way. I think when I met you, you were still doing the puppet thing.
Yeah.
And that was the big bit. And it was a pretty creepy bit.
Yeah.
And you were sort of hung up, I imagine, because you were into the comedy store. I could tell by the look in your eyes that you were, it had hold on you.
Mm-hmm.
So you sort of felt the tangible darkness of the place.
Yes.
And felt that you were part of that.
Yes.
And then at some point you extricated yourself and became a more, you fought the forces of darkness, contextualized them, and freed yourself somehow. But in order to have the tools for that, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes. It's great. I love it. I wish I'm going to have to go back and listen to that and get it
It'll
tattooed
be available.
On my stomach.
Extricate yourself from the darkness. Get a handle on it.
Yeah.
But I mean, but when did you first start dealing with, you know, a more cosmic approach to things? I mean, at what point? I mean, Ram Dass didn't affect you in the car, and then you took acid in 10th grade. But where did you start? Where did your brain start to kind of blow open?
Yeah. You know, man, the funny thing about that is anytime you think my brain's really gotten blown open, it's, I don't know. I don't want to seem like I'm dodging that question. I don't know the answer to that. And I think that sometimes the way, spiritual growth works is it's a very, very, very slow process. And, sometimes people do this classic thing where they start pretending to be spiritual or something, you know, like they like,
well, yeah, or they grab at fragments. There's a lot of that. I know somebody, I'm not saying it's a negative thing, but to actually grasp something intellectually that you can make sense of does not mean that you can connect it to your heart or whatever you call the soul or its connection to the universe at large.
Right.
You can sort of like, oh, I get it. But you don't really get it
right.
Until it gets you.
Yes, yes, yes. That's it exactly, man. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So you see the whole thing as kind of like a, you end up, in the beginning when I was really getting into this stuff and like reading Be Here Now or reading the Bhagavad Gita.
When was this? How many years ago?
Well, this would have been in high school when I first came in contact
with
it a little
bit. So who gave you that? Who gave you the Bhagavad Gita?
Before the Bhagavad Gita, it was...
Was it a guy at a mall who had a shaved head?
No, but I did hang out with the Hare Krishnas for a while.
It's good food.
Great fucking food, man. And it's trippy, man. Yeah. That is some trippy shit.
All right, so we'll get there.
So the first contact, I guess, would have been... There was a book my mom had called Raja Yoga by Yogi Ramacharaka. And I still remember it was a blue book. Really fancy looking, and it had on the spine a circle with a triangle in it. And
ooh,
it just
symbols.
Seemed, woo!
Yeah.
Very symbolic, man.
What does that mean?
What could it mean?
Yeah.
So then I started reading it, and that's the first time that I ever I may have come in contact with the idea, but the first time I really came into contact with the idea that you're not your thoughts.
Right.
Your attachment to your thoughts.
Yeah.
The idea that what you think defines your personality or that you are this ego is a delusion.
Yeah.
And so that was in this book, and the book had all these different exercises you could do that were designed to sort of take you out of the concept of you.
So this was like a magic book, in a way. In the sense that, like, here are these exercises, which for most practical purposes are rituals to facilitate this idea that you had just gleaned. Did you do the exercises?
I did one of the exercises.
What was it?
So the exercise is you begin to refer to yourself in the third person, whatever you're doing. When you're walking around, you're just like, he is going to his car. He is sitting down. He is driving. He is listening to the radio. He feels sad. He feels happy.
Uh-huh.
And so this is just like, there's a lot of different versions of that exercise, but it's designed to sort of cause you to zoom out a little
bit
from yourself.
And,
another great practice, which I just read about, which is really fun, and they say this is like the first thing that, and I can't remember which sect of Buddhism it is, but when you become a monk, the first question they ask you is, where are you in your body?
Yeah.
Tell me where you are in your body.
Are you
your hand? Are you in your heart? Are you your feelings? Find yourself in your body.
And
the more you sort of meditate on that, you realize, fuck, man, I'm not in my, I'm not here.
No, I'm just a puppet for something bigger.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I hadn't ever read anything like that before. And so I think that was probably the beginning of it for me.
When that yoga, what's it called?
Raja Yoga by Yogi Ramacharaka, who was a, by the way, turned out to be some English guy named like Stephen Williams or something. Yeah. I looked it up later. He was just called himself Yogi Ramacharaka.
Why not?
He would sell books.
Sure, man. The hucksterism is a very important part of modern spirituality.
Yes.
Yeah. You got
a huge part.
Gotta have a good act.
You gotta have a good act, man. You gotta be fancy. You have to have some special fucking angle. It's hilarious.
Well, yeah. You are somehow facilitating the shredding of fragile egos.
Yeah.
And then you must be able to implement yourself as their channel, their portal into some larger understanding, which may or may not be true.
Oh, right.
But the point of the matter is anybody you talk to has been involved with those type of things. They're like, yeah, I was in that for about 8 years until I realized, like, you know, I just needed a job.
Well, that's what I love about Ram Dass, is because he addresses that stuff in such an articulate, brilliant way. And what he says is these different things that we get pulled into, Buddhism, Christianity, whatever it is, existentialism, becoming like a hardcore activist, skeptic, whatever the thing is, they're self-destructing traps. The best ones are self-destructing traps, and it's designed to get you in there and not keep you forever. It's designed to get you in there until you, like, wake up or just get what you need to get out of it.
Right.
You know, and not stay in it for your entire life. It's not, it shouldn't be a trap.
Right.
It's like when you drive to the beach, you don't then just sit in your car. You go hang out on the beach.
Right. If most people thought about that, and I think that's probably the recidivism rate, is that what it's called for those kind of situations? It's probably fairly large. I mean, imagine a lot of people split. You know, if the leader doesn't crack up entirely.
Yeah.
But the people that stay are usually the people that, you know, do the office work.
Right.
You need somebody to run the business, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's what's so funny about deciding to, like, meditate or get into this stuff and go into whichever way that you want to go into it, is that it's not about becoming something else. And it's not about deciding that this person or that person is the conduit for all truth in the universe. That's a ridiculous thing. And that's a weak thing, you know, I think. And it's really fucked up how people will allow themselves to seem like that thing. Like, they'll pretend that they're
the racket.
It's a racket.
Yeah, but I also think the unspoken part of it is, more so than not, is that, you know, if somebody's lost and they're in a tremendous amount of fear, they need something to grasp onto. But I think a lot of people, and I talk about this idea a lot here, is that, you know, people need to feel part of something. And a lot of people don't have the fortitude to necessarily get to where you are, which is to forego the middleman after a lot of research and just realize that you're part of something all times anyways, and everything is in flux, and that's it.
Yeah.
Some people need, like, a little more definition than that.
Yeah. Right.
So you're the guy that knows the thing. Okay. I'll be here with you for a while with these other people. What do you got?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it seems like the best teachers are the ones who don't allow that to happen. You wouldn't want that to happen. I don't think you would want that to happen. You would want, ideally, I would think, people to just recognize that you're just as much a part of the thing as they are. I mean, you're all part of the...
Right, but unfortunately, you know, business is business for most of these people, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, that is... Yes, I think so. I think some people are definitely... They've just made that weird decision that I'm going to fucking juice people and let them think I'm God.
Yeah.
Can you imagine?
It's a lot of responsibility.
Oh, you have to love people.
And you also have to have no fucking conscience whatsoever on some level. I mean, you can love people, but what it takes, the sort of blind side and gift that it takes to actually, whether you believe it or not, to remain in that position, to know that people are following you.
Yeah.
Either you've got to really believe it for yourself, or you know somewhere in your heart that I'm taking these fucking people for a ride.
Yeah, yeah.
So sadly, if you are a person that believes that you are that person, that God, that entity, then you got problems.
Yeah.
But if you're a person that's just taking people for a ride, it's a different set of problems.
Yeah.
And something, you know, a little more dubious, but at least understandable.
Yeah.
Because then you're not necessarily a psychopath, you're just a fucking con man. But if you really believe it, then you got bigger problems.
Here's the biggest fucking problem, is that in the midst of all these monstrous charlatans, there are people who really wake up. There are people who wake up.
They serve their purpose.
Yeah.
It's like the shitty teachers at high school. You never know. They get through sometimes.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, there are real... I do believe there are gurus. I do believe that there's teachers and people who've just done... whether by like mutating their brain or maybe it's like a terrible accident or who knows, but they've somehow figured out a way to just become love or just generate love for people around them. Yeah. And I think that's possible. And it does happen rarely, but I think it does happen. So,
two questions. Where do you fall on the it's wired into us versus there's some sort of external continuity?
Okay. Have you ever read the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali?
No.
It's fucking amazing, man. You should check it out. It sounds esoteric and hard to read, but it's really badass to read about the psychology. Like he has this whole system of psychology in there, which is this idea that you have the external world, right? And the external world is reflected inside of your mind.
Yeah.
And that's definitely true. Like you can't argue with the fact that photons go into your
nerve. Our perception of the external world is limited to our perception.
Yeah, well, our perception of the external world is a neurological biochemical reflection of the external world.
Okay.
So the idea is that, you know, you have a person in your mind, someone you don't like, I don't know.
Yeah.
And so that happens a lot when someone's done you wrong or you're holding a grudge.
Right.
You'll think about this person and then you'll feel pissed off, you know, you'll get angry. Right.
Right.
So the name that for that aspect of your brain.
Show business?
Is that. Yeah, right. Show business is in your brain, man. But that's called a vritti, which means kind of like a cyclone or tornado. So like spinning in your mind are all these little cyclones and tornadoes, which represent people that you like or people you don't like.
Uh-huh.
And they're all replicas of the thing that you encountered in the external world. But
right.
That creates the illusion that the person that you're somehow connected to the person,
you're
mad at someone, you're connected to them, but you're really not. You're just experiencing this little, tiny little part of your brain that is a biochemical reflection of that person.
Right.
So when people, and I do wonder, like, is it outside of us or inside of us? And then I just start thinking, well, I don't think it matters because we are outside. Like, you're part of the universe. Like, you're as much a part of the fabric.
I'm a very large part.
A wonderful part,
too. Thank you very much.
Yeah, but you're as much a part of the universe as a rock or a mountain or the sky. So when people are like, is it outside of us? It's like, well, you're it.
All one.
What's outside of you anyway?
Right.
You know, all one. Exactly.
Right. So, all right. So getting back to your first experience, you brought up the ego and the idea of moving the ego aside or at least breaking it down. You're talking about Ram Dass, that his guru was able to free him from the ego long enough for him to have some sort of enlightenment or to find some sense of universal love or that type of possibility or continuity. I mean, when did you know that was on the menu? I mean, was it from that first book? I mean, when you say he is going to sleep, he is driving a car, that is an exercise to what? To distance yourself from the vessel. But I mean, ultimately, what is to explain to me the idea of ego eradication?
Well, it's not eradication.
Okay.
And that can create a lot of problems for people because they start thinking like, okay, here we go. I'm going to get spiritual, so let me just destroy myself because it's just so awful. I'm going to have to get rid of it.
That's trouble.
That's fucking trouble because now it's like, now you're at war with yourself.
And
like,
also it leaves you vulnerable to being a fucking, psychic dumpster.
Yeah, exactly, man. And it creates all this guilt. It creates all this guilt and it's like, you know, most of us from, you know, when we were kids, the thing we always experienced was this, our parents putting pressure on us in some way or another to be something different than the way we are. So that's been the status quo for most people for their whole lives. It's after the parents, the school will tell them to be someone else. And then after that, you know, the job maybe will like, they're always under pressure to not be who they are. So it's not ego eradication. It's more of a surrender to just accepting like the way you are right now, this way that you are right now.
Yeah.
This is perfect. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't. That means you can just keep eating Doritos or don't exercise or.
No, it just means that, like, if you don't accept it, the possibility of you not only being miserable but continuing to do what's negative is high.
Yeah, man. Exactly. That's exactly it. And the one thing most people have not tried is the practice of loving themselves. Most people have, they think that that's selfish or indulgent, or when they hear it, they're like, what are you, how?
Well, yeah. Well, I think what it is it's sort of daunting, because I think that what the West does is really keep us in a state of unmeetable desire. That, you know, capitalism in and of itself exploits desires. It requires you don't feel comfortable in order to persist. If you don't need things, then the whole system falls.
Right.
So, you know, you got to be in a state of perpetual need, and you got to feel like you're not quite whole unless you have that thing. I need that thing.
Yes.
And how much does that thing cost? Well, there's a cheaper version of it. It's a pretty good thing. Maybe I can afford the expensive thing. But any of that, you know, if what you're saying is, you know, full self-consciousness and the ability to self-love is a threat to the order of things on a larger level. But on an individual level, I think, unfortunately, we're wired to believe that success, ambition, and hard work, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, that we're really wired to believe that we're never enough. You know, whether it's by your parents or culturally, that, you know, like, I'm not quite there yet, or, you know, it's never enough. You know, it's not the process, it's the result. Very result driven, career driven.
Yeah.
So loving yourself, I mean, the big question is, like, why? Why would I do that?
How will I be able to survive?
Yeah, I mean, I got things to do.
This is hell.
Yeah.
How am I going to suffer in hell if I love myself? You're going to ruin hell for me.
And also, surrender is difficult because it does require that. And you brought that up. It does require that. You know, allowing yourself to accept love, you know, that's tricky for me.
Oh, God. Have you figured it out? It's so hard.
It just makes you cry. You know, the weird thing... It's just like,
so
I don't know why it's so uncomfortable. I can't quite figure it out. You haven't tracked it in yourself. Why? You know, 'cause a lot of people are just like, I think about entertainers. I was talking about this to another guy the other day, is that, like, so many entertainers just bask in the love of the audience. I'm like, not my experience. I will defy them to like me. And when they do, I'll question that.
Yes.
So, but where does that come from?
Yeah, well, because what it is it's fun to be like, if you become somebody who lives in their mind, then the idea of being in your heart is a really tough transition.
But don't you think that the act of living in your mind is somehow it's avoiding your heart?
Oh, 100%.
It's a defensive action because, you know, you're so sensitive or something, or somebody took advantage of that, or somewhere along the line your heart got broken, and probably at an age where you couldn't even understand it. I mean, I believe that you know, heartbreak can happen, you know, very early on.
Well, like, heartbreak, it's a funny thing. Like, people run away from heartbreak.
Can't avoid it.
You can't fucking avoid it. And also, it's like, when your heart breaks, that is, I think the thing that a lot of people call heartbreak is actually contact with truth. And so it's that feeling of actually touching ground on the terrain of the world that you're at, that you're
in. Is it truth or is it humility? I mean, it's truth. Like, I think heartbreak a lot of times is similar to that moment where you realize things did not work out the way you wanted to. You don't have control over most shit. And somehow or another, you've been rejected by something.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that's a truth. But a lot of times heartbreak happens because you're untruthful. But I guess I think the truth is humility. Then.
But even if it's untruthful and heartbreak comes, then that feeling of loss is that's contact. Well, yeah, it's the truth is
you've just been handed your ass.
You were attached to something. It didn't work out the way you thought it would work out.
Yeah.
And now you're experiencing that incredible feeling that people call heartbreak, and it doesn't feel good. And of course you try to get away from it. You try to get away from it at all costs. And it's a very strange thing, because when you begin, that's like when you begin to meditate, or when you begin to one big part of sitting is you stop running away from the heartbreak. So you sit and you follow your breath, and then you look at the way your body feels, which is interesting in its own right, because you'll notice, like, shit, man, my calf hurts. You'll have, like, these pains that you didn't even notice. Like, oh, weird, man, that fucking hurts.
Oh, yeah.
And then the more you do it, suddenly you, like, go into yourself and you realize, like, oh, man, I am so fucking lonely. Holy shit, I am lonely. And then instead of doing the thing that when you feel like that, a lot of people, when they feel like that, they're like, I'm going jogging, yeah, or like, you know, I'm going to play video games, or I'm going to get stoned, or whatever it is, you know, not that getting stoned is going to help you with your loneliness. It will amplify it. But the point is you go into that. The idea is you just keep trying to go back and back and back.
Until you accept it.
Well, yeah, until you accept it and yeah, I guess that's the right word for it.
Accept okay with it.
Yeah, until you're okay with it and just surrender to the fact that guess what? At this time in your life, right now, you're lonely. Stop pretending you're not. Stop acting like everything's okay. Stop walking around like you're fine. Be a lonely person for a while.
Yeah.
Let that be what it is. Stop trying to be different than the way you are. Nothing's wrong with you because you're lonely.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you fucking be lonely? Look at where you're at.
Yeah.
You're surrounded by people. Yeah, you pathetic shit. No one loves you. And look in the mirror and say that over and over and over again.
Yeah, see, that was a dark turn. Everything was.
Guys, I'm releasing a series of guided meditation tapes.
But you're in your own personal journey. I mean, like, clearly, so you read those books in high school and then you drop some acid. But I mean, what has been your desperate spiritual search?
My desperate spiritual search?
Yeah. How'd you land here? Because I know when I first met you, this was not where you were.
Well, you know, this year I got one of my balls chopped off and my mom died. That's not going to, like, that's a wonderful space.
That's a wake-up call.
That's a wake-up call.
Those are two truths.
Those are two big...
You're a ball shy and no mommy.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that the name of your new CD?
It is.
A ball shy and no mommy.
That just sounds like the saddest kids song. Just like some orphan singing that in front of a factory.
I'm a ball shy and I got...
No mommy.
Like tons of kids singing. That's where everything turned around. In a way, where were you before that? Where were you before the cancer? What were you doing?
Well, you know, I had fucking hubris, man. Like before cancer and my mom dying, I think that I was like, I took people for granted in a way. Just didn't even know I was doing it, you know? Just sort of like took people for granted, took what I don't know. I think I was...
I have to assume that at that time... Well, I know you were sort of, you know, locked in with, you know, with a certain way of thinking and with, you know, other comics, and there was the darkness of the store. And, you know, I have to assume that, you know, in terms of your spiritual path now, you have to look at that as some diversion.
It's a big diversion, man. And I was touring and because of the podcast, I was getting people at the shows.
Yeah.
And it was great. It was really great. And then...
But you were compelled by morbid fascination and darkness.
Yeah, I went through a period like that, for sure. I know exactly what you're saying, man. I know exactly what you're saying, and you're damn right. Yeah, like, I did the puppet. Like, I performed the puppet act at the wedding of the grandson of the founder of the Church of Satan in front of a bunch of Satanists.
And you were into it.
Well, I was fascinated by it. I really was. And I think that's actually a lot of... I know a lot of people who get into that or get into some version of that.
It was Anton LaVey's grandson?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But people get into that stuff, and I know why they get into that.
Yeah, because it's sexy.
Well, yeah, it's sexy, but it's also because they think that they think that, like, power works, you know? Like, they think that, like...
Right,
like,
the will thing.
Yeah, which... You know, like with Crowley, people confuse like Aleister Crowley with Satanism a bunch, but yeah, it's not at all. It's not Satanism at all. But his idea is do as thou will, shall be the whole of the law. And then the next line that no one ever says is love is the law, love under will. So the idea is like your love is the most important thing.
I think that most people that enter the world of Crowley after about four pages go like, I don't fucking get this.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure. There's a lot of force fields surrounding that stuff for people. And then, I mean, fuck, do you want to get it? It's like your great joke about Scientology where you're afraid to read.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
How does it go? I love that joke.
I can't remember. It's like, you know, I don't even pick up the book because I don't know where it happens. At what page you're like, I'm in.
Yeah. You know, do you really want to end up standing in your fucking living room
at
6 a.m. wearing robes and doing the...
Where to now, Mr. Cruz?
No. So, so I think a lot of people, it's an easy thing. And it's not just with like Satanism or the occult. So many people get pulled into other power games, you know, like they get into becoming a pickup artist or they get into like, they get into like that book, The Laws of Power, and they think that everything's about manipulation and everything's that, like, winning at all costs, no matter what, and they pretend to be
It's so funny because, like, those are the same people that go the other path. I mean, there's a desperation there. There's a desperation for personal advancement, for feeling like you can achieve things.
Yeah.
You know, the same people that are looking for some sort of transcendence or some sort of spiritual guidance.
Absolutely.
Are the same people that are like, there's a moment at the end of The Wolf of Wall Street. Did you see The Wolf?
I didn't see it.
I think it's a great movie. But there's a moment at the very end where he looks out at an audience and that is it. That is just sort of like, help us. We're lost. Our lives aren't working out. Help us.
Yeah. Yeah.
That vulnerability that we all have.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it, man. And that's the whole, the whole idea is like, you can do whatever it is you want to do, whatever you're drawn to doing.
Yeah.
Do it. Don't suddenly decide. I mean, not everything, guys. Yeah. Don't fucking set churches on fire or anything like that. But in general, if you just like recognize that there's so many different ways to start waking up. And that can even include like Satanism, which really Satanism, I would say, is just a Western version of worshiping Shiva, which is the force of destruction or the force of power in the universe.
Unleash all your desires.
Well, I mean,
feel your hatred.
Yes, yes, that's it. That's the idea. And it's like, I think that there's something to be said for that.
I know, but it's like, you're not going to win a lot of friends necessarily, maybe within the group. But,
you're going to get sick too. I mean, I think that like, if you're an angry person and you let yourself hold on to anger too much, then your body's probably going to get sick.
Well, I mean, did you practice in any way the ideology of it? I mean, cause I know that LaVey was sort of a huckster himself, but I mean, and some of the principles he was playing with in the Satanic Bible, you know, were old magic principles. They weren't anything that he invented necessarily.
No, I wouldn't say that I didn't practice. I just thought, you know, you hear some of the stuff you hear. And if you're like, if you're an angry person or if you're somebody who like, is, I don't know, it's a really easy, like you read it and you're like, well, that kind of makes sense. You know, like,
that feels good.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Fuck that guy.
Yeah. And you know, like I see it as a kind of art experiment too. Like if you look at the I can't remember, there's a new satanic church. These are the guys who I don't know if you heard about this, but they wanted to put a statue of Baphomet in front of a Capitol building somewhere because they had a statue of, I think, the Ten Commandments.
Yeah.
And so they were saying, look, if it's freedom of religion, we get to put this. Have you seen that picture?
No.
Oh, it's awesome. They're like raising money. I think they're going to go to court over it, but it's a statue, you know, Baphomet,
he's the Egyptian, right?
Well, they say he's Egyptian, the goat of Mendes, I think. Yeah, it's sure. Like, so it's
the
that
horned guy
pointing up, pointing down, hermaphrodite.
Oh yeah.
So it's this hilarious statue of that being sitting in a throne with two children at either side of him.
Yeah.
And it's
with the Lincoln Memorial in the background.
It's exactly. It's so diabolic, man. But
but nothing's as diabolic as the Pentagon. So I mean they're in some stiff competition.
Well, that's a funny thing too, is like people who get overwrought about that stuff, they seem to be completely ignoring the fact
draw some lines across the points and there's the biggest pentagram ever constructed.
Or just look at history and you can see since the 50s, I think the United States has killed at least 500,000 people.
Yeah.
So don't forget that. I mean, it's like, don't forget that you're probably living on the great dragon of the world if you're an American.
Sure.
500,000 people, man. That's a lot of fucking people. I was looking that up yesterday and just sort of, it's kind of mind-boggling when you consider that number.
Well, yeah. I mean, I used to do bits about that, and you sort of look at the grid of Washington and all the sort of Masonic symbolism and Egyptian symbolism and symbolism in general.
Yeah.
You know, I try to stay out of that rabbit hole.
Yeah, I think that the it's a fun rabbit hole to go into, but definitely it's just a diversion. I mean, all those conspiracies, it's like people who like
are... It's a fun rabbit hole to go into, but not to live in. And the risk of, and you know this, the fragility of the human mind to somehow take a turn and believe it's seeing something that may or may not be real, but because it offers some sense of order of history, of good and evil, they'll lock in.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you're one of those guys.
Right.
You know, like, oh, here he goes again.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's part of the conditioning is you're not supposed to say that the United States has killed 500,000 people since the 50s. Like, you don't, you know, that seems like something before they say the Pledge of Allegiance, the teacher should say.
Yeah, but you say that to me, and I'm like, that number seems a little low.
I think it's low. It's a conservative estimate. It's a conservative estimate. But it is, you know, and then you start saying that stuff, and it's strange because people will roll their eyes at you like, really?
Yeah.
Just don't talk about that.
Can't you just live for today?
Just live for today. It's like out you're at a party that runs on blood.
Yeah.
And it's a great fucking party. And you're telling people, you know, this thing runs on blood. And they're like, shut the fuck up, man. This is the best party on the fucking block.
Yeah.
Look at the other parties.
Yeah.
You can't be gay in some of the other parties here. Yeah. You can be gay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let it run on blood.
Yeah. Yeah.
A wedding party here and there. We must sacrifice. We have to sacrifice. The dragon must be fed. Just drink the margaritas, yeah, man.
I think we're feeding the dragon now.
I don't know, man. I think that you can get caught up in that stuff.
Well, that's a fucked up thing too, is that, you know, how much of, you know, what, you know, when you look at like the 9/11 truth people or Lyndon LaRouche people, you're like, we've become sort of untethered from any sort of like human unity that we know of. And we're able to cherry pick our ideology, our information, what we consider truth, what isn't truth. So I'm completely convinced that all the truths are out there, but it's just sort of like, maybe you'll come upon them, or maybe you'll say they're bullshit, but it's all available. There's nothing being hidden anymore.
Right. Well, I guess just assume everything's happening. Just accept that fact and then deal with what's inside of you. Because if you really
nothing is true, everything is permitted.
Just deal with your own chemtrails in your heart. Stop worrying about the fucking chemtrails in the sky when inside of you, you're polluted with anger and greed and sadness.
Right. So that message is, being available and opening your heart to universal love is ultimately the only solution.
I mean, what else are you going to do? I mean, and that doesn't mean you can't continue to like be
feed the dragon,
be an activist.
Yeah, right.
Whatever. You could still, you can shovel fucking dead babies into the dragon's mouth, but it would be better if you're going to shovel dead babies into a dragon's mouth. It would
be crying.
It would be. No! No, that's creepy! There's something so creepy! Laugh while you do it. No, you wanna... I think that it's better to start practicing mindfulness. So if your job is scooping dead babies into the mouth of the dragon, then the first step in maybe getting away from that job, maybe...
is how does he feel when he's doing this?
Is just watch yourself do it. Yeah, are you really enjoying watching those lifeless corpses land?
I got no choice.
Yeah, just watch that. Just watch that. And then the more you watch it, it does seem like that's when some small change happens.
All right, so you go through this, you know, relatively dark period in the name of your creativity, and then tell me about the ball cancer diagnosis. I mean, what happened? Walk me through that.
Well, so one of my balls got really big.
Big?
Well, it was, you know, yeah, it was big, man. Yeah. It was weird and big, and I knew something was wrong. But you think to yourself, well, I think the other day I accidentally hit myself in the balls, maybe. Yeah, like, you try to remember something. Yeah, like, maybe you were, like, did squats wrong or something.
Right.
I think I was exercising at the time, so it was like... probably an athletic injury. You go on the internet
and you
look up your symptom, and it's just like, yeah, you've got cancer. Like, it's just like, you definitely probably have cancer. And so
I feel like checking my balls right now.
You would notice, man.
Okay.
And also, you're out of the age range statistically where people, I think people can still get it, but I was at the very end of like the age range when you get it. For those of you listening, getting paranoid about your balls, it wasn't like, I wonder if something's wrong. It's like, something is fucking wrong. Like, this is wrong.
Right.
So don't get paranoid and scared. Because a lot of guys rightfully get paranoid and scared, and they'll start feeling their balls compulsively to see if they have cancer.
Yeah.
And then that'll make your balls sore if you're always squeezing and touching them. So you've got to, like, just go to the doctor, get a checkup. It's stupid to not get a checkup. But anyway, I went to the doctor. I still remember that day, man. I'd been writing in this cafe with this, because I'd gone to get a checkup and I showed this like general practitioner, and he's like, oh, no, that's bad. You need to go to a urologist immediately. So then, and that's the last thing you want to fucking hear, man.
Yeah.
And it's just like, anytime you go to the doctor, when you're an immortal, which is if you're a person who hasn't gotten sick yet, and a lot of people haven't, you're just like, I'm going to walk out of here with a big grin on my face. He's going to see the ball and be like, come on, man, you're fine. Get out of here, champ, you're fine.
Yeah.
So then it's like, you're sitting there, you can feel you can just feel this darkness rising into you. That's like, oh shit, this could be it. this is going to be my thing.
Yeah.
This is going to be the thing. And so then I'm writing at this cafe before I go to the urologist, and like, I'm just like, oh, this is probably going to be nothing. I'm going to get in there. It's just nothing. Waste of time. Funny story, though. Big cancer scare. I'm going to tell my friends I had a little cancer scare. Boy, it was scary.
Yeah.
Really terrified.
Yeah.
And I'm driving there, and then I get there. And I remember even thinking, like, man, you're going to be so relieved when you find out you don't have cancer. And I remember thinking, I'm going to go buy some of those. I don't even know why I thought this, but I've been wanting those LED color changing lights you can control with your iPhone. After this, I'm going to go buy those crazy fucking lights.
Yeah.
I don't know why. It'll just be a celebration because I'm fine.
Yeah.
You get there. Doctor comes in. Show him your ball. He's like, this is something we should do an ultrasound for this right now. We need to do an ultrasound because this is definitely enlarged.
Right.
They're asking you all these questions about your past. Like, does anyone in your family have cancer? Well, my mom had breast cancer. And then like, did your balls descend? That's what they asked. Like when I was a kid, did my, which they did. But, so then the ultrasound's happening, right? So you're laying on the table. They're using this sonar device to kind of scan your balls. You're looking at the lady's face. You can't see the screen. And if you could, you wouldn't know what you're looking for. But you're looking at the lady's face because you want to see what her expression is. Because you think, if she sees cancer in my ball, I'm going to be able to tell on her face.
She's going to go, oh, fuck.
Jesus Christ. You're dying. But this is that they do this all day, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just a kind of a blank face. And I'm asking her, how am I doing?
Yeah.
Looking okay?
Yeah.
She's like, well, you know, we can't say. I can't give a diagnosis.
Right.
And then suddenly you're sitting at a desk in front of a doctor. Just like in the fucking movies.
Oh, boy.
When you're sitting at, when your doctor is at the other end of a fucking desk.
Yeah.
I don't know why they do that. I don't know why they want to fucking sit at a desk when they tell you you have cancer. I don't know if
that's part of it. Would you want them to be holding you?
Yeah, I would prefer anything. Just sneak it in or something. Like point at something and then you have cancer.
Right.
But yeah, he's like, well, there's a 90% chance that this is cancer. And we are going to need to schedule what's called an orchiectomy.
Uh-huh.
And where we're going to cut your balls off. And
both of them?
You're one.
Yeah.
And we're going to... we should do it next week.
Yeah.
They don't take, you know, they're like, and he's like, and then after this, we're going to send you down to get a CAT scan. And because we want to make sure that it hasn't spread into your lungs or into your brain.
Yeah.
So that's the moment where your hearing goes away.
Yeah.
That's the moment where this, like, suddenly you can't hear anymore. And it's the weirdest fucking thing, man. Like, you really do have that experience of seeing someone's lips moving, but you can't hear anymore because you now are a person who has cancer. And, like, 5 minutes before, you thought you weren't. And then you get, someone escorts you to where you go to get the CAT scan. And
right after you talk to the doctor.
Yeah. Because they're like, you have cancer. We have to get this out of you immediately. You have cancer, so there's no time to delay.
Yeah.
This has to get out of your body. There's no time to delay. I had shows coming up. I remember asking the doctor, I was like, well, can I put off this surgery until I do the shows? He's like, you have cancer. He's like, you can't delay this thing. Like, no. Because your logical mind is like, well, you know, I'll just put, this is something we'll take care of, doc, but I've got to take care of, you know, business first.
Mm-hmm.
So this woman escorts you because they know that you're in shock and they know that you're not going to be able to like find your way through Cedars-Sinai. So they escort you to where that you get your CAT scan.
Yeah.
And at the time I'd just gotten into a relationship with somebody. So I'm just thinking like, shit, man, is she going to break up with me because I have fucking cancer? Like now she's dating a cancer guy, you know? So I'm looking at like a relationship maybe ending on top of my life, maybe ending. And of course, getting one of my balls chopped off and just like, what's this going to do to my life? And then, but it's like all these thoughts are swirling through your mind. You've got to call your family and tell them, you know, that this is going to happen. And so it is, I just can't describe that feeling. It's just a feeling of absolute helplessness. There is no escape. It's that feeling in a dream where you're like experiencing the very worst thing and then you're like, I'm gonna wake up.
Yeah.
And then you wake up and you're like, fuck, that was awful, but I'm fine.
Yeah, close one.
No wake up.
Yeah.
You don't wake up.
Yeah.
And so I think that was so what ended up happening is that I had actually stage 2A testicular cancer, which meant that a couple of my lymph nodes were enlarged. So could have been cancer. Maybe it wasn't cancer. Didn't matter. After I got my ball chopped off, I had to get radiation therapy for a month. And that, Holy shit, man. That is the most fucked up thing. Getting your ball chopped off is like quick, easy. They give you Dilaudid, shitloads of Vicodin. You just get to sort of float around your house in like an opiated one ball haze.
Yeah.
But getting fucking radiation, wow. Every day you've got to drive to this facility. You lay down in this H.R. Giger looking machine. They were playing like for the longest time, they were playing like Gloria Estevan, what's her name? Just like terrible music, yeah. As you're getting irradiated. You're essentially getting your internal organs microwaved, but you lay down on this thing where your a lead cod piece is placed on your balls, and you lay in this thing, you can't move, and the machine sort of like zzz, 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 RoboCop style, this giant machine sort of rotates around you, it's scanning you, finds the place where the lymph nodes are enlarged, and there's this awful clicking noise, tick, 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 tick. And then, so that's it, it's over really quick, you put your clothes on, and then right around like 5 p.m., you just want to vomit, you start feeling so sick and tired, and they give you this awful anti-nausea medication that just makes you like just fucking so tired all day long. You just feel like you have mono and you want to puke. It's like being carsick for a month straight.
Ugh.
That was fucked up, man. And then after that, you have to go in, you know, every 2 months. You go in for all these follow-up scans.
Yeah.
And then after that, you've got to wait a few days to hear if the cancer has returned and spread through your body. So you're always being like, it's not like it ends.
Yeah.
It's like you're constantly getting this weird exam that you go to where if the doctor said, where if something shows up, you got to get chemo now.
Yeah.
Your hair is going to fall out. You've got to get fucking chemo. So that again and again pushes your face against your own mortality. Again and again pushes your face into the impermanence of your life and the impermanence of whatever thing that you're doing. Whatever it is that you're doing. Whether you're the fucking president, whether you're a janitor, whatever the thing is that you're doing, that thing will immediately get disrupted, inevitably, by disease.
Right.
Which happens to all people.
Right.
It's
going to happen.
Yeah, it's definitely going to fucking
happen. How long have you been clean of it?
I just went in for, oh God, I've been clean of it for about a year, and now I only have to go in once a year, and I just went in for my last chest x-ray, and everything's fine. So now it's once a year I go in and get these tests. So,
congratulations.
Thank you, my friend, but it's the testicular cancer is the most treatable form of cancer. There's like a 93% cure rate, if not more. So it's just terrifying. I mean, no matter what, it's fucking terrifying.
And then when did your mom pass during all this?
Well, my mom passed, so that happened while I was right after my radiation therapy ended.
So it was sudden, or
no? She had breast cancer for years.
Oh, sorry.
So man. And it spread into her bones, yeah. And then
horrible.
It is horrible. Yeah, it is. It is really fucking horrible. But it's also exactly what happens in this dimension if you have a human body. You don't get bone cancer necessarily. Cancer is terrible, but
you're going to leave the vessel.
You're going to bury your parents.
Yeah.
So that definitely is going to happen. And all those things, man, it's like, you know, sometimes people will say to me, oh God, man, you just had the worst year ever. And I always think of that Charles Bukowski poem, that it's the broken shoelace that sends a man to the madhouse. Have you ever read that poem?
I don't think so.
Oh, it's so great. It's not the big, the big catastrophes.
It's the last straw.
It's the little droplets. It's the Japanese water torture of life that's so much more intense. And that's kind of why there's so many.
What book is that in?
I don't know. It's, I don't know.
What's it called?
Google search, it's the broken shoelace, Bukowski, and it'll pop up.
And this was the one that kind of knocked you out?
This didn't knock me out, but I think this is like, this is to
me. The shoelace, a woman, a tire that's flat, a disease, a desire, fears in front of you, fears that hold so still you can study them like pieces on a chessboard. It's not the large things that send a man to the madhouse. Death he's ready for, or murder, incest, robbery, fire, flood. No, it's the continuing series of small tragedies that send a man to the madhouse. Not the death of his love, but a shoelace that snaps with no time left. The dread of life is that swarm of trivialities that can kill quicker than cancer and which are always there. License plates or taxes or expired driver's license or hiring or firing, doing it or having it done to you, or roaches or flies or a broken hook on a screen, or out of gas or too much gas. The sink stopped up, the landlord's drunk, the president doesn't care, and the governor's crazy. Light switch broken, mattress like a porcupine, $105 for a tune-up, carburetor and fuel pump at Sears Roebuck, and the phone bill's up, and the market's down, and the toilet chain is broken, and the light has burned out, the hall light, the front light, the back light, the inner light. It's darker than hell and twice as expensive. Then there's always crabs and ingrown toenails and people who insist they're your friends. There's always that and worse. Leaky faucet, Christ and Christmas, blue salami, 9-day rains, 50-cent avocados, and purple liverwurst. Or making it as a waitress at Norm's on the split shift. Or as an emptier of bedpans. Or as a car wash. Or a busboy. Or a stealer of old ladies' purses, leaving them screaming on the sidewalks with broken arms at the age of 80. Suddenly, two red lights in your rearview mirror and blood in your underwear. Toothache and $979 for a bridge, $300 for a gold tooth. And China and Russia and America and long hair and short hair and no hair and beards and no faces and plenty of zigzag but no pot, except maybe one to piss in and the other one around your gut. With each broken shoelace, out of 100 broken shoelaces, one man, one woman, one thing enters a madhouse. So be careful when you bend over.
Ah!
Yeah! That's it.
Oh, feel better?
Yeah. That was cathartic. That was great.
So, to finish up here, when this happened to you, you became mindful.
Yeah.
And your spiritual practice became defined.
Yes.
And what is that?
I just meditate every day. I read and I meditate. I try not to be reactive to my anger, but when I am, I don't beat myself up over it. I don't think that I'm like, what the thing that it's really, if it's given me anything, it's just given me the realization that I'm probably not going to change. You know, it's like gotten rid of that delusion in my head, and it's allowed me to really just accept that this is how I am. This is how I am. And sometimes I send shitty texts to people who fucking piss me off. And sometimes I like act happier than I am because I want people to think I'm peaceful when I'm not. But sometimes I really am peaceful. It's just it's an always changing thing. It's just given me a chance, if anything, just to see that. Little individual flakes that are floating around in the snow globe of the self, that are often hidden to us, can be opened up when you sit down to meditate or run or whatever. You don't have to sit down and meditate. Do whatever. The idea is just stop moving for a second. You know, the whole fucking world is moving and moving and moving and moving. They're always like poking you with some kind of emotional cattle prod to get you to go and go and go and go and go. You don't even know what you're going for. And it's like that idea, that realization, like, fuck, you know what? I'm not going to like, I don't want to run around like that anymore. I don't want to do something just because I think I should be doing it. If I'm not inspired by something, I don't want to just keep doing it. So that's what cancer and dying people teach you really quickly, is it's just a cliche. All the cliches, all the songs, live like you are dying, all the country songs. It's really true. There's a reason that those cliches emerge, and that's because if you've gotten into this fucking terrible trance and you're flying on co-pilot, or autopilot rather, you're just running around like some fucking android that's just running this repetitive loop over and over and over and over again, so that you're not happy right now and you're not even trying to be happy, you're not even trying to be anything. Look how fast time flies, man. Like, think when you go on vacation. That vacation you've been looking forward to for 6 months, going to Hawaii for a week. All of a sudden you're on the plane coming back from Hawaii.
Yeah.
You are never even fucking in Hawaii, because the entire time that you were waiting to go to Hawaii, you were looking forward to Hawaii into the future. You were habituating yourself to this constantly looking forward to the next thing. You get to Hawaii and suddenly you're supposed to be in the moment. Now you're just thinking about getting the most out of that vacation. Really, ring that vacation. Ring the fun out of that fucking vacation. You got to get the most out of it. That's what they teach you. And then suddenly you're on the plane. Well, I think the same thing happens with your fucking deathbed. This whole life gone. And then suddenly you're like laying on your deathbed, an IV drip of morphine going into your arm. You're in some kind of hazy fog. Whoever you love is maybe sitting next to you. Maybe you're alone. Maybe no one's there. And you think, holy shit, I'm dying. And that's it. So it's like, I don't want that moment. I don't want to be laying on my deathbed. I'm certainly not living so that I can have a wonderful death experience. But I just want to live before I die. And I know that's a cliche too, but I think there's something to be said for certain cliches.
Yeah, absolutely. There's some things are repeated. Look, I think that the human experience, in a practical sense, when it comes to life or death, it's a fairly short menu. There's certain things we know are going to happen, and there are certain desires and things that we do to ourselves, but it's not some weird, like, huge book of shit. They all fall under the rubric of one or two things, and I think what you're saying is true. Those sayings are true for a reason, but again, like we talked about earlier, is you can wrap your brain around it, but to wrap your being around it is not going to happen until they wrap themselves around you.
Yeah, that's true.
It's good to talk to you, man.
Great to talk to you too, Mark. Thank you so much. What a blast.
Thanks, Duncan. What else? Oh, my God. I'm exhausted. Boomer lives.